Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Wheelock, Judge Eade, the Honorable Judge Jeannie M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. We have five cases on our calendar today, two oral cases and three non-oral cases. And as you know, we record the oral arguments here. The recording should be available tomorrow on our website. For purposes of the recording, today is April 17th, 2024. Just going to take one quick minute here, and then we'll get started with our first case. The first case on our calendar today is A22-0332. State of Minnesota versus Joseph William Curtis. As you know, you'll each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock on the podium, and the podium is adjustable. We'd appreciate it if you can introduce yourself and the party you represent at the beginning of your argument. So with that, you can proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court. My name is Stacy Bettison, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Joseph Curtis. We all have an interest in bringing justice to victims of sex crimes, particularly vulnerable children and adults. The idea of a sex offense on a developmentally disabled child is highly offensive, to say the least. But this is not that case. I am representing to this court in earnest, as I have represented to the prosecution, that this case presents a very real possibility of actual innocence, that an innocent man is sitting in prison for 20 years because a 15-year-old boy, J.H., whose cognitive functioning level was that of a first grader, made up a story of no less than five iterations that Mr. Curtis sexually assaulted him. Now, the prosecution calls these perceived conflicts or inconsistencies at their brief, page 26, but they are not perceived. They are real inconsistencies, and they are troubling. There is simply no way to review the testimony of J.H. and not have serious questions about his competency, whether he had the ability to recall facts, and whether he had the capacity to tell the truth. The questions regarding his competency were not a minor or a close call, and his incompetency was painfully obvious in the first few minutes of his testimony at trial. Here, in the first few minutes of testimony at trial, the state was trying to establish competency, but they could not. These are the same questions that the judge would have asked in a competency hearing, but J.H. failed to demonstrate his competency. It should have been clear to the court, the district court, that a competency hearing was required for this witness to ensure the integrity and fairness of the judicial proceeding.
Counsel, would you agree that we apply the plain error standard in reviewing this argument?
Yes, Your Honor, I would.
Okay. And would you also agree that case law provides that the determination of a person's competency as a witness is within the sound discretion of the trial court.
Your Honor, I would agree with that. And I would add that here the trial court abused that discretion, and that's the issue, is the abuse of discretion. And an abuse of discretion is where there's clear error on factual, on facts, and error in law.
So how was the district court not sua sponte evaluating the victim's competency plain error when it doesn't appear that it doesn't appear that you've cited any authority which suggests that it is error to allow a witness to testify given, you know, that determination is within the district court's discretion? I guess I'm not, you know, for an error to be to satisfy the plain error standard, the error has to be clear, and I'm wondering what case law you can point us to show that there's clear error here.
Sure. So the clear error is, well, it's one in the facts, that the prosecutor started to question the witness as to his recollection of that they talked about before a trial, which was question, do you remember what we talked about before we came in here? Answer, no. Question, you don't remember that? Answer, uh-uh. Question, do you remember us talking about telling the truth when you were up here? Answer, no. You don't remember that conversation? Do you remember that I asked you to talk loud and tell things that are uncomfortable? No. It should have been abundantly clear at that point that this witness did not understand the oath to tell the truth and was not able to recall even just most recent facts.
But isn't that also something that typically happens when you have a child witness? You'll have a child witness, it's particularly in a case like this, get up with nerves and perhaps not be able to immediately respond to questions like that. Isn't the bigger issue for your argument that where it counted, for example, as to the victim being 15 years old and being able to say what his birthday is, what his age is, what grade he is in school, where his parents, his mother and father live, what his father does for work, he can answer those correctly. And so he demonstrated through other testimony his ability to truthfully relate the facts. And so how is it clear error when the record doesn't just stop where you left off, but continues and contains those other indicia of competency?
Sure. Well, the very plain question of, do you remember that we talked about telling the truth, that answer never came out. And that was in the first few seconds of the testimony. Now, in terms of case law authority, where is the authority that the district court erred here? The trial judge must safeguard the administration of justice, and that judge has a responsibility for protecting both the rights of the accused and the rights of the victim, and that's from Salitro, State v. Salitro, 499 Northwest 2nd, 815 Minnesota Supreme Court, 1993. The trial judge is not a passive moderator at a free-for-all, Salitro informs, and the trial judge has an affirmative obligation to keep counsel within the bounds and to ensure that the case is decided on the basis of relevant evidence. And yes, the witness did answer his birthday, what his father's name was, et cetera. But from the beginning of disclosure, when J.H. disclosed this incident, all the way through the forensic interview, all the way through trial testimony, and all the way even through post-conviction, the testimony was inconsistent, displaying that it was not reliable. It was, in fact, it was contrary to, the facts were contrary in many cases.
But aren't those inconsistencies left to, at least at the trial phase, to the discretion of the jury as the fact finder to weigh credibility and decide whether or not, as counsel pointed out in closing for Mr. Curtis, that these inconsistencies are reasons to discount the testimony entirely, or whether or not these inconsistencies are minor inconsistencies, and that overall the main facts that the victim testified to remained true, and that they could rely on that testimony.
Sure, and credibility determinants of credibility are within the province of the jury, and competency is the trial judge. And those are two different things. And so to put a witness up that is incompetent and then just kick it over to the jury to determine the credibility, that was the error.
But you're not arguing that every witness who testifies inconsistent with the prior statement is incompetent to testify, right? I mean, that can't be the basis
no,
here.
No, we're not making that argument. But the inconsistencies were throughout this entire prosecution, the entire case. It's not just an inconsistency in time one and time two. It's an inconsistency between time one, time two, three, four, five, et cetera. And the judge was made clear, or was knew that the inconsistencies had been present throughout this case. The judge was knew factually when she decided to allow the state to lead the witness in the very beginning of the trial versus assessing the competency. The judge was aware, and her radar should have been up, that J.H. is severely disabled and operates at...
Counsel, you keep saying that the testimony was inconsistent, and then you also say that consistency and competency are two different things, but it seems like you're pointing to inconsistencies to try and show that there was incompetence here. So if you could maybe clarify that for us, and then point to whether you have any case law that supports the notion that inconsistency is the equivalent of incompetence, that would be helpful.
That inconsistency is?
Equivalent to incompetence.
Okay. I am not saying that inconsistencies, I agree that the jury is to determine the credibility of the witness, and if there's inconsistencies, they need to resolve that. We actually don't know what happened in this case in terms of how the jury reconciled the inconsistencies, and that gets to the other issues that we present in this appeal, which is the relationship evidence that came in. That may have been one way that the jury resolved the consistencies, not on credibility, but on relationship evidence, which was erroneously admitted. In terms of the judge and the judge's duty to make sure that competent witnesses are testifying, that is a distinct job of the judge as opposed to the province of the jury. And we can't today sit here and say, well, how did the jury reconcile the inconsistent testimony?
Well, I think we do that. I think we have case law that says that when the testimony was inconsistent, we assume that the jury believed the information that was presented consistent with the verdict.
Well, and that is true, and I don't dispute that case. What our issue, though, is that as a threshold matter, the court was well aware that there were inconsistencies and there were problems with false allegations from the get-go. As I was saying, that J.H. also had an imaginary friend. He had a history of fabricating false allegations. He also had recanted his past assault allegations, and he had recanted the accusations in this case. And the judge was aware of all that. And again, this was a simple inquiry that should have happened, where the judge simply asks a few questions. And we have state...
Isn't another problem that the jury was also aware of all that? So when say we agree with you that this was plain error for the judge not to sua sponte find that J.H. was incompetent, isn't there another problem that the judge's error doesn't necessarily affect your client's substantial rights if all of these problems with J.H.'s testimony and his competency and his inconsistencies were very thoroughly highlighted in closing, which they were, and that was all before the jury to decide? So how is it that we should find that, even if we agree this is plain error, that it affects your client's substantial rights?
Again, this goes to the other issues that we raised in this appeal. For example, the relationship evidence that was admitted to show similar conduct from domestic abuse as similar conduct to a sexual assault. Now, the jury may have heard about the domestic assault incident that happened after the alleged or the incident between J.H. and Mr. Curtis and use that to resolve the inconsistencies. But that relationship evidence should have never come in. Also,
is that relevant to the credibility of J.H.'s mother in supporting Mr. Curtis? And wasn't that relevant for the jury to evaluate aspect of the evidence before?
That's what the judge said, but the case law would not support that. You know, the state uses State v. Valentine to support its proposition that evidence about how a defendant treats his family member or household members illuminates how he would act close to them, and that this did go to credibility. But the judge, that case, Valentine, was all domestic assault cases. It wasn't a domestic assault used to in trial to prove up the elements of a sex crime. The DeBar case that we cited in our brief goes to the relevance and materiality of this relationship evidence and whether there's a sufficiently close relationship between the charged offense in time, place, and modus operandi. The analysis is not whether it goes to credibility of Jennifer Hermel. It was whether it was probative of the issues and whether there was a prejudicial impact on the defendant. And the district court conducted no such analysis weighing probative to prejudicial.
That's if we agree that the only ground for admissibility for that was 634.20, right? I mean, if there was another basis to admit that evidence and we disagree that the only ground to admit the prior domestic or the post-domestic abuse was 634.20, what's your response to how should we find that that was error if it's not being admitted under 634.20?
Well, that it was more prejudicial than probative.
Which we would review under an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes. Yes. I'm sorry.
Except for plain error, right? Because was this objected to, this aspect of the...
The relationship evidence was objected to. I'm quite certain, and maybe the prosecution can correct me if I'm wrong on that. The bottom line here, I see my time is out. I will come back for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I am here on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. I am asking this court to affirm the convictions in this case and the district court's denial of post-conviction relief. I'm asking you to do this because the district court did not commit plain error when it did not sua sponte conduct a competency evaluation when no one raised the issue. Because the evidence at trial was sufficient to support the jury's verdicts. Because the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it admitted the relationship evidence. Because the trial court did not commit plain error when it did not sua sponte strike the testimony of the social worker in this case. Or the admission sua sponte prohibit the admission of the social worker's interview with J.H. that the parties agreed was admissible, because the district court did not abuse its discretion when it denied appellant's request for a continuance of the post-conviction hearing. And finally, I will acknowledge that the district court in this case did err when it entered convictions on counts 2 and 3. So that is the one issue of the 9 that we agree on today. So because appellant is essentially raising 9 very distinct issues, unless the panel has questions about sufficiency, my intent would be to focus my argument on the legal issues in this case and rest of my brief on sufficiency. So starting with the district court, the allegation that it was plain error for the district court to not sua sponte, stop the proceedings and hold a competency hearing on this witness. That was not error, and it was certainly not plain error. I think it's already been discussed that there's no case law that would support that argument. But more importantly, just practically looking at this, at what point is appellant arguing that the district court was supposed to suddenly stop the proceedings and make a decision that it needed to hold a competency evaluation? Halfway through the victim's testimony, it's unclear why it would be error for the court to not do that. If you look at the transcript in this case, and it's kind of hard to pull things off of paper, but I think you can see what happened here. This victim got up on the stand, and there was a lot of trouble at the beginning of his testimony. He wouldn't pull his mask down. He was hiding. You couldn't hear him. The prosecutor asked him a lot of questions that he just kept saying no, that he didn't remember. And the prosecutor actually asked for a recess.
So given those responses that he didn't remember and the court's awareness of his medical condition, appellant argues those circumstances are sufficient to put the court on notice that it should have conducted a competency hearing. Can you respond to that specific argument as to why it wasn't plain error in the the specific circumstances in this case?
Certainly. Those initial few responses where the victim was indicating he didn't remember certain things, specifically that the prosecutor told him when he testified he had to tell the truth, that doesn't establish incompetence. The victim's not required to remember something the prosecutor told him to establish competence. He was sworn in. He swore to tell the truth at the beginning of his testimony. The fact that he doesn't remember something that the prosecutor told him doesn't necessarily equal incompetence. And then throughout his testimony, again, like I indicated, the prosecutor took a break fairly almost immediately when she realized he was shutting down. A recess was taken. There was discussion about the fact that she disclosed the conversation she had with the victim during the recess to defense counsel, so there were no concerns about that. They resumed, and J.H. did well. He did as well as he could with his deficiencies, and that problem seemed to have resolved itself after the recess. So there was nothing at that point that would trigger the court to stop and then have a competency hearing when the victim was adequately answering the questions.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Judge Cochran.
Would you agree, though, that the capacity to remember goes to competency?
It does, but it's not. Witnesses regularly will not remember things when they are asked questions, and that is not going to immediately go to incompetence. If not being able to remember or being inconsistent equals incompetence, I would submit to you his mother, Jennifer, was incompetent.
Well, but the issue isn't necessarily, I think, I framed it in questions to your counterpart about whether inconsistency always means incompetence, but certainly it would be relevant for the district court to consider inconsistencies in deciding whether or not a witness is competent. If the inconsistencies were significant enough, that might point towards incompetence. Wouldn't you agree?
Had that issue been raised and the district court been in a position to make that decision, certainly that might be a consideration.
But it wouldn't also be your position. Like, if the testimony proceeded without anyone objecting and saying, I would like a competency hearing, or without a motion in limine, you could imagine a certain set of facts where the witness's testimony was so far afield from truth and reality that it would be clearly erroneous or plain error for the judge not to say, hold on, we need to consider whether this person is competent to testify, right? It can't be that there's no set of circumstances, even though the judge isn't obligated to do that under law. There can be circumstances under which a judge arguably would be plain error for the judge not to question competency. Wouldn't you agree?
I would not ever say that there would never be a situation, because I never say never. There could be a situation where it would be so bad that perhaps you could have facts to support plain error.
Sure. So
but they're not in this case.
So let me ask, and just say we disagree with you on that, and we assume plain error. I want to ask you about substantial rights here, because one of the things about this case that's a little troubling is the some of the inconsistencies in the victim's testimony in connection with this production of these audio tapes and videotapes afterwards, where there's a lot of recanting going on. So can you address why this is not something that violated Mr. Curtis's substantial rights, even if we assume plain error?
Certainly, and I think you're asking me to address the third and fourth prong of the plain error standard, and I'm happy to do that. So the third prong is, has appellant met his burden to prove that by not sua sponte holding a competency hearing, his substantial rights were effective? Has he proven that the outcome would have been different had the court held a competency hearing? The problem in this case, and this is why we want people to address things in district court and not ask this court to decide it, is because the court didn't hold that hearing, we don't know what the court's decision would have been on competency. So how can this court say that had they held a competency hearing, the outcome would have been different? Maybe they would have held a competency hearing and Judge O'Brien would have found incompetent. So you're in a position where there's a hole there because you don't know what the outcome of that proceeding would have been. Furthermore, on that same third prong, everything that appellant says as to support their argument, and I'm not agreeing that he was incompetent, but all of these inconsistencies they're pointing to, the fact that the jury saw those, and it almost... I will say it was the trial strategy to capitalize on those deficits and those inconsistencies and things he was unable to say. The jury heard all that and still found him guilty. So it is, I think it shows that his substantial rights were not affected, because the jury still found, as to the core parts of the offense and the elements that he testified to, that he was credible.
Would the forensic interview have come in as evidence, even if the judge found that J.H. was incompetent?
He would not have been allowed to testify at all. I believe there would be Crawford issues with trying to admit it as hearsay without the victim testifying, because he would, I believe, you know, I haven't thought that through. But
was a forensic interview, was that testimonial?
Yes. Yeah. Sorry, I hadn't thought that into that case, but I mean, I think there would be difficulties without J.H. testifying.
I'm just asking because what other evidence in the record could have come in if the judge had said, no, J.H. can't testify, and the forensic interview goes to some of the facts underlying the charges, obviously, and the accusations. So I was curious as to your thoughts of whether that would...
I think it would have been difficult to proceed without J.H. testifying. But that would be my assessment of the case. And then looking at really the fourth prong that the court often doesn't get to on plain error is reversal or a new trial required to protect the integrity of the proceedings? And I would argue in this case it's the exact opposite, that it would be contrary to the integrity of our district court proceedings to allow appellant to come here today and say it was so obvious that he was incompetent that the district court should have intervened, when appellant himself did not raise the issue, used all of those inconsistencies and deficits to argue credibility, and then when that doesn't work, he gets a second bite at a trial by saying that the district court erred by not intervening when he didn't intervene when he was listening to the same testimony.
Well, he could have done that anyway, right? He could have, the trial counsel could have asked for a competency hearing, lost, and then still made the same arguments that he did. I mean, I don't, why should we fault the trial counsel for not doing that. I mean, we don't have an ineffective claim in front of us on that ground, but why is that significant, that those issues were highlighted? Why should we be thinking about trial strategy in analyzing this?
I think it just goes to what the effect was on, you know, what the effect was on the verdict, that the jury heard all of these inconsistencies. That was part of the trial strategy. And it just seems like it would not be fair to give the appellant a second trial when he sat through the same testimony that the district court did and didn't raise the issue.
You're talking about the fourth prong, the fairness and
integrity.
I see.
Yep, correct. And just moving to another legal issue, the district court did not abuse its discretion in this case when it admitted the 63420. This was objected to, so abuse of discretion is the standard of review here. But this evidence was very probative of Jennifer's credibility in this case. And this, her credibility was very important. I know appellant would like you to only focus on JH's credibility in this case, but you have Jennifer testifying not only about the facts of the offense and the facts surrounding the offense to the extent she could remember them, but also about statements she made after the offense, interviews with law enforcement and things that she said, and most importantly, she came in and testified that JH had recanted to her and said that this never happened. So
counsel,
her credibility was really important.
Your time is winding down. I'm wondering if you can speak to, am I correct, there were also photographs that were submitted?
I think there were a couple of photographs of the injuries to her to support the fact that this assault occurred, because again, nobody knew if she was going to acknowledge it or deny it or recant it when
she
testified.
She did testify that it occurred, right?
She did, but the trial judge had to make the decision about the admissibility of the evidence prior to her being asked about it. So the trial judge made the decision at the beginning of trial and found that it was relevant. So then it was asked about when she testified, and she did admit that the assault occurred. That is correct.
Can you address for us then the issue of whether that evidence was actually more probative than prejudicial?
I think it's still probative because that assault occurred about 90 days before she came into trial and essentially defended him and described him as a protector of people. So if she's in this abusive relationship, or if she's fearful of him, or we don't know what led to that assault, that might explain why she would be coming in and testifying on his behalf making this claim that her son had recanted the abuse. This all occurred after he assaulted her. And again, as far as the probative versus prejudicial analysis, the court had to make that decision at the onset of trial. And the fact that she, when she's questioned about it, acknowledges that it occurred rather than saying, no, that never happened, I made it up, he never assaulted me, the judge doesn't know what she's going to say prior to the evidence being admitted. So it is true that once it was admitted and she was asked about it, she acknowledged it, but that doesn't make it any less probative. And as far as the prejudice of it, again, you know, of course it's prejudicial, but the question is, did it persuade them to convict him of the sexual assault of J.H., through improper means? And it really didn't go to that issue. It was more about Jennifer's credibility. So it did not influence the jury through improper means. The court provided the required cautionary instruction. And now, obviously, I'm moving to kind of a harmless error analysis, if you were to find.
So, counsel, your time is up, so if you can conclude briefly, unless
Thank
the
you.
Panel has other questions. One other question,
Can I just very briefly, this was not plain error because there was a pretrial objection.
Correct.
On this. And then the other question I have for you is with regard to vacating count two, I note that you in your brief had stated in a footnote that we need not address the sufficiency argument. My question for you is whether or not that's still your request of the court. If we don't address the sufficiency argument and later there is some successful challenge on count one, then it would seem to me that the issue being presented today should be decided by this court so that it need not be decided later since it's fully briefed. Do you have a position on that?
I think that's reasonable.
Okay, thank you.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel for appellant.
I think that is important to understand that there is no other evidence in this case that established the elements of the crimes charged other than J.A.'s words. And his words conflicted with each other, canceled out each other. The way he described this, it started off with contact over the clothes in the kitchen, under the kitchen table. There was no kitchen table, we later learned. It started off with him sitting, then he was standing, his mother was awake, his mother was not awake. The allegations are wildly inconsistent, and it was just his words that brought this over the finish line.
Were the allegations actually wildly inconsistent? It seemed like they were consistent in terms of the nature of the sexual abuse that he recounted when he was talking with different people about the allegations.
His first statements in the forensic interview were that they were standing, that his mother was asleep. His trial testimony says that they were naked the whole time, and then he walked in, that Mr. Curtis demanded that he take off his clothes. He also testified at trial that he walked into the room without his clothes on to go sleep with his mother. He testified that he laid between his mother and Mr. Curtis, but then later he testified that Mr. Curtis was assaulting him on the side of the bed and they were standing.
It goes on and on. The conviction may be upheld on the basis of a single witness's testimony?
So, the law is that one person's testimony can be enough evidence. It can be sufficient evidence to uphold guilty verdicts. But this testimony is so across the board unreliable that that's part of our insufficiency argument on the alleged or on the counts.
None of the inconsistencies indicated that there would be a different degree of the crime of which Mr. Curtis would be guilty, correct? So that distinguishes this from Bakken. Right? I mean, the standing versus sitting, clothes on, all the things you're pointing to, none of them make this a more severe crime.
He also said that there was no contact with the mouth, and then he did say that there was contact with the mouth. So, the fact is, we don't know really what happened based on what J.H. said from his disclosures, said from in the forensic interview, and said at trial. We don't know if there was penetration to the mouth or anal penetration.
This is all direct evidence, right? It's J.H.'s testimony.
That would be direct evidence.
So our standard for direct evidence is that we assume the jury believed the evidence that supports the verdict.
What evidence? I mean, what was it? Was it that there wasn't penetration to the mouth or there was penetration? That there wasn't penetration to, there wasn't anal penetration, or there was, because it's all conflicting. That is the very problem with this. And, the state says that what if the court would have held a competency hearing and found him competent, then obviously no prejudice. What if the court would have held a competency hearing and found him incompetent? Certainly that would have affected or, changed the result. Now, in Minnesota, courts regularly hold competency hearings of children, and they ask questions.
So if you agree that it's possible, both that the if a competency hearing had been held, that that the witness could have been found incompetent or could have been found competent, they're both equally possible, then how is it that you've proven that the outcome would actually be different?
Well, if he would have been found to be incompetent, he wouldn't have been able to testify. And that gets into whether the forensic interview would have been admissible. It wouldn't have been because, as counsel acknowledged, there would be Crawford issues. Because J.A.'s words is the only evidence in this case, then that impacts the entire case. Without those words at trial and without that forensic interview, because they can't get in the forensic interview due to Crawford issues, that's how this case changes. Now, the post-conviction hearing, I want to just touch on that really quickly. I have 8 seconds. Again, inconsistencies. Whoever asks J.H. a question, whether it's leading or not, whoever is asking the questions gets the answers that they're eliciting. That is the problem with this witness, and that's why we ask this court to reverse the convictions and remand for a new trial.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments here today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statutory time frame.